Welcome to the politicalbetting.com polling matters show. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, today we're going to be looking back at the Tory party conference, the first, of course, for Theresa May as Prime Minister, where she addressed some of the key issues facing the country, of course, Brexit being the most important of all. What does the Prime Minister's future hold as she tackles a very daunting intro, including negotiating Britain's exit from the European Union, whilst keeping her party together? Right now, she seems absolutely unstoppable. Will that last into the future? I'm joined today by Rob Vance and Matt Singh to find out more. Gents, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, as usual, let's take our sort of typical approach of each taking a topic and then discussing it. Later on, Rob, you're going to be talking about the race for the White House. Matt, you've been looking at some sort of polling around Westminster voting intention and whether we should have a snap election or whether that would benefit the Tories. But before I get to some of those issues, I wanted to introduce my own topic, which I've hilariously titled, in my own words, Great Brexit Expectations. Now, essentially what I'm looking at today is the fact that, yes, it looks like Theresa May is unstoppable at the moment. We all know her poll ratings are extremely strong vis-a-vis Jeremy Corbyn. She's certainly got a honeymoon bounce in the polls. But at the same time, as I alluded to in my introduction, she has a very tough intro as well. And part of that is obviously, well, the main part of her prime ministerialship is going to be negotiating Britain's withdrawal from the EU. And one of the things I've noticed looking at the polls is that the public have very, very high expectations in terms of what can be delivered. So to put some numbers to that, 57% think the government should do a deal on trade and immigration before the next general election. So a clear majority expect this to be wrapped up one way or another before we go to the polls, if we assume that's in 2020. And that might sound like a long way away, but there's obviously, we know, a lot to be done. So that's not, shouldn't be taken as a given that a sort of secure, permanent deal will be done by that time. And what's even more important for the Prime Minister, I think, is that 69% of Tories and 79% of UKIP supporters want this deal done before the next general election. And these are the people that obviously have the most immediate short-term ability to put pressure on her in terms of what she's doing. Secondly, 52%, or a majority, expect to stay in the single market with some restrictions on free movement. This was a ComRes poll in July. Now, I'll come to in a moment the fact that polling around that area is a little bit hit and miss. But the point is, again, that very high expectations that we can kind of get what we want on trade and immigration, you know, have our cake and eat it too, so to speak.
Which, of course, is the Foreign Secretary's line. So, I mean, it's not an unreasonable for the public to think that.
Absolutely. And, you know, and finally, 50% of Brits, according to YouGov, think negotiations, although there aren't really any at the moment, are going badly, whereas only 16% think it's going well. So there is this trepidation. And I guess my point is that, yes, she looks untouchable at the moment, and, you know, for good reason, the data is very clear about this. But actually, given that expectations are so high about what Brexit can deliver, and given that people are already maybe, I don't know, to an extent getting impatient, I certainly can see them being impatient by the time we reach the new year, you know, it's not all going to be plain sailing. And I think that's an important point to mention. Before I come on to my second point, which is around the kind of single market immigration point, I want to get both of your views on Tory party conference. I mean, Rob, what's been your assessment of the sort of last few days and how Theresa May's done and maybe where the government is at the moment?
So I think, well, the first thing is that there's a sort of solidifying consensus that we're going to have some kind of hard Brexit, which I think is a pretty significant thing. It had already been started, you know, movement towards that kind of position. But, I mean, this is why I think the July ComRes study might be feel a little bit dated now, because I think in July there was quite a lot of chat of, well, if not having one's cake and eating it, at least that the single market was still going to be very important. Lots of prominent leavers saying, well, obviously we're going to try and maintain trade and so on. It seems like through the course of the summer, that sort of view of the single market being of paramount importance is getting lower and lower, and people are already talking about which industries are going to be sacrificed on the altar of free movement and so on, which is a very different kind of conversation going on, which seems to be going on at Tory Party conference. I think two interesting sort of developments from May's speech. One, in terms of the obviously fairly hardline, at least rhetoric on immigration, which felt not necessarily new, given her, you know, approach as Home Secretary, but certainly was given quite a lot of prominence, which I thought was interesting, and has obviously created its own backlash, particularly amongst, you know, the what you might expect to be both the pro and anti that kind of view in the media. And then the sort of stuff about, you know, a bigger role for government, a sort of slightly strange bit of warmed-up Milibandism, which wouldn't have been my candidate for being top billing on the briefing of her speech this morning, but evidently was pretty significant. So, yeah, I think sort of a solidifying view around a hard Brexit, tough on immigration, and sort of warmed-up dirigiste 80s Milibandism.
Matt, what do you think?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, if anyone was in any doubt, the May approach is clearly very different to the Cameron approach. And I think the one talking point that's kind of come out of it, which Rob has kind of touched upon, is the fact that on some issues she can be seen as moving to the left, in some cases to the right. I mean, on economic type issues, there was an awful lot about fairness and making the country work for everyone and taking a robust line on big business and the city and so on. But on the more sort of social issues, I mean, obviously the immigration thing and the thing about foreign workers and other things like law and order, it's seen as moving much more to the right. So it's a clear departure from the Cameron platform, but in a not in a straightforward left-right way. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have talked about, you know, Mayism is certainly not Thatcherism. But the interesting thing is that the sorts of voters, the sort of blue-collar conservative voters that Thatcher is credited with bringing into the Conservative Party, this sort of rhetoric, at least, that May is adopting is the kind of thing that could well be targeted in their direction.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way. I want to move on to the EU kind of Brexit negotiation, if you like, and what happens next. I've been looking at some polling about this apparent trade-off between access to the single market and controlling immigration, which we've talked about on this show before. But I guess a point that I wanted to raise was around immigration. Obviously, the hot-button issue of the day, I think it's safe to say, upsetting a lot of people on the left and certainly motivating a lot of people on the right. And I've looked at two different polls, one taken in July by Comres, one in August by Lord Ashcroft, that have very conflicting messages about what voters prioritise of the two. So those on watching the show can see on screen what I mean, but for the benefit of those sort of listening in, the Comres telephone poll in July suggested that 66% of voters prioritised access to the single market over controlling immigration, whereas 31% prioritised controlling immigration. Lord Ashcroft's online poll in August had pretty much the reverse, 28% prioritising access to the single market and 52% prioritising controlling immigration. So what's going on here? These can't be, you know, the same. It's apparently the same subject, completely different picture. And what you find is that actually the way you ask this question ends up giving you a very different answer. So to use the Comres example, which ended up saying that access to the single market was much more important, their wording gave people the choice between maintaining access to the single market so Britain can have free trade with the EU versus restricting the freedom of movement so that immigration from the EU is reduced. Now, I'm not criticising that wording, but, you know, it's as good as any other. But just, you know, on the one hand, you've got a real strong explanation of what the single market gives you in terms of a benefit versus a sort of reduction in immigration, which doesn't mention anything to do with, you know, a significant change, in my opinion. I think that's a kind of relatively soft impact of that measure. On the other hand, Lord Ashcroft, it's a slightly more long-winded question, but he refers to negotiating Britain's exit from the EU may come down to striking a balance between having continued access to the EU single market and having control over who can enter, live and work in the UK from Europe, which should the government prioritise. And on that question, I think the sort of discussion around the single market is much more abstract, less clear benefit in terms of what's going on, whereas, you know, the controlling the rights of who can live and work in the UK is much more, there's much more clarity there, it's much more clear. And I'm not attributing everything in the difference in these polls to those that question wording, but it does seem to me, Rob, that actually the way you frame this question is really important, right? And I guess that my point would be that when everyone's sort of sacrificing, I think you used the phrase, you know, sacrificing free movement or sacrificing different industries on the altar of free movement, maybe, you know, being so bold about that isn't quite as clear-cut as we're currently led to believe.
No, I think public opinion is understandably, you know, divided on this. And I think how you frame it is really important. I mean, it's what a lot of my work is, which is trying to work out ways of framing issues in such a way that you can build a coalition of support. And it seems that clearly May's rhetoric, I would say, today suggests that, you know, the managing and controlling immigration and side of stuff is going to be prioritised, and that if it's framed in that kind of way, it's likely to find popular appeal. And I'm sure if you looked at the cross breaks of that, you would find that. I mean, one of the striking things about Tory conference this week is, like, where have all the kind of economic liberals gone? You know, where is the entire economic board of Remain, which was, you know, represented the
George
first
one, the last one left?
Well, yeah, but I do think think it's interesting that, you know, they've been, you know, really quite silenced. A few kind of the Ken Clarks of this world, but are sort of easy to write off in the same way that some of the Labour left were written off in the early Blair years as just sort of, you know, old dissonant voices that, you know, have no place in today's sort of political conversation. But yeah, I think the issue is that, especially at a time when you've got various the triumvirate of sort of Brexit ministers saying that you can control immigration or you can get rid of freedom of movement and have some kind of free trade deal, as long as that persists, then people are always going to prioritise the immigration side of stuff.
And the interesting question is that if, as we assume, that at some point that line is going to have to change, what then, you know, how, where does the blame fall? Is it seen on them, or is it seen on me personally? And, you know, however it breaks out, in that case, how does that then affect voting and so on? But I think it really does, as you say, really ram home how important the question wording is, particularly on these sort of more abstract concepts, which, I mean, single market access membership to the ordinary voter is a pretty abstract concept. And I think, I apologise to the person that said this, because I've completely forgotten who it was, but I heard it said that including the word control in the question can have a big impact on how people answer it. Whether it makes it less accurate or more accurate isn't clear, but it is one of those loaded words that has a big impact on...
Was so effective in the referendum campaign as well.
Just to pick up on something that Matt said there, I mean, I think the in a sense, the responsibility that Theresa May holds for this is a really, really interesting question, because I think... You know, the stuff about the negotiations not going well, people have a lack of clarity on this. At the moment, she's kind of getting a pass, I think, from the public, who understand that this isn't, like, in a sense, this isn't her mess, and that she's kind of been given the benefit of the doubt for, like, all right, we'll get, you know, got these three guys running around the world who she's sort of put on the case, which people are, I think, probably quite rightly sceptical of. At some point, that's going to pivot to it being her responsibility for making a call about which side and how to negotiate and what the government's line's going to be on this. I don't think we're quite there yet, but I think that will be a really interesting thing to see as you start to see more of a correlation between Theresa May's own popularity ratings and the rating of how we're doing in terms of the negotiations. And I've no idea how the reporting of the negotiations is going to go. I mean, it's going to be we've got, 6 months or so until they actually trigger Article 50, and then we've got 2 years of trade negotiations, which presumably are going to happen mainly behind closed doors with bizarre leaks that aren't probably going to be helpful.
And also I think the thing is that, you know, a lot of these public pronouncements at the moment, either from the British government or from the EU, are negotiating stances in their own right,
of course,
aren't they? You know, it's all about how you sort of portray your image at the moment. I mean, my suspicion is that, we were talking about this off air, Matt, weren't we, that in the end there will be some kind of transitional deal. I can't see how you can wrap it all up in 2 years, and it will be a case of, right, we leave the EU, there's a transitional arrangement for X years, let's call it five, I don't know how many it will be, and then Theresa May goes to the country and sort of asks permission to sort of complete the process, I suppose. But on that note of going to the country, Matt, you've been looking at some of the recent sort of voting intention polls for Westminster, and specifically around this idea of whether Theresa May should call a sort of snap election, or at least an early election. And what have you found?
This early election thing is starting to remind me a lot of the Alan Johnson Labour leadership thing, where no matter how many times he said, I'm not going to do
it. It still happened.
Well, I think we'll leave that one there. But,
yeah, leave that one there.
Yes, I think, I mean, if you look at the headline numbers in the polls, the ones that got the attention, the ones showing big leads up to 15 points, which is huge considering that, you know, the Conservatives are in government, you know, almost a year and a half after the election. But the interesting thing is that when you look into the detail of these, a key part of these Tory leads is coming from the assumptions that the pollsters are making about turnout and differential likelihood to vote. Now, we know that in a normal election, the sorts of people who vote Conservative are more determined to vote than the people who vote Labour. So I'm not suggesting for a minute that these adjustments are wrong, but... The question has to be, and just to put numbers on it, so the average lead in the headline numbers in polls done during September was about a 10-point Tory lead. That's in the headline numbers, so they mostly include all the turnout adjustments. In the figures that include all voters, the average was about 7 points, which is only very fractionally bigger than the 6.6 that they got at the last election. Now, I'm not suggesting, as I say, for a moment, that these adjustments are wrong, and all the indications at the moment are that in 2020 or 2019 or whenever it eventually is, that the Conservatives would be favourites to have quite a big win. The point that I'm making is that this a snap election would not be a normal election. Every parliamentary term since 1974 has been 4 years or 5 years or thereabouts. We simply don't know how the public, and bear in mind the voters are very fatigued, people have had enough of politics, it would be the third major national vote in 3 years, on top of the devolved elections. Campaigns are a lot longer these days because of fixed-term parliaments, and we knew when the referendum was going to be and so on. So people are a bit fed up. How would they take to a government going to them and asking them to give it a bigger majority, which, let's remember, is for the government's benefit or the Prime Minister's benefit? It's quite hard for the voters to see how that's in the national interest. So in that situation, taking all of that into account, is this assumption that the turnout does favour the Conservatives as we'd think it would in a normal election, does that hold, or does it instead go into more of a like a midterm election or a by-election type scenario where turnout is lower and the people who want to vote against the government are more determined to vote than they would normally be?
And we know that the Labour Party has lots of passionate supporters who support Jeremy Corbyn very strongly. And I suppose you're not arguing there that the Labour Party would somehow win by 5 points, but maybe the result would be very similar to the last general election. And depending on how the vagaries of the first-past-the-post electoral system play out, maybe the Lib Dems take some seats in the South West. Suddenly the Tories could find themselves, even if they win by 6 or 7 points, without a majority, couldn't they? And things are even worse.
It's certainly the risk. I mean, I suspect that it would... I don't think that is hugely likely, but it's certainly a big risk to take for what would probably be a relatively small gain in majority. I mean, on the current boundaries with the uniform swing, even if it were the 10-point lead, that would still only be a majority of 40 or 50. It's not... The upside is relatively limited.
I'm ignoring 40 or 50 would be a hell of a lot more useful than 12, right? I mean, we're already seeing that grammar schools could die on the back. I mean, in the Commons, let alone when it gets to the Lords.
Yes, but bear
in
mind that 12. I mean, okay, on that specific issue is perhaps, but the 12 is really 16 once you count the abstentions, and then you've got DUP, UUP,
Labour people not showing up.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then we're ignoring the boundaries here, of course, as well, the redrawn boundaries.
But they wouldn't be used.
There's an obvious incentive to not call an election.
Right. Yes, exactly.
I mean, the public seem to back you, Matt, at the moment. YouGov have a poll out, and 36% think there should be an early election. And by early, we don't necessarily mean right now, we mean before 2020, this poll says. 46% say there shouldn't be. So lots of evidence of that election fatigue. Slightly hilariously, Labour voters are the ones that want an early election, but... Yeah, presumably because they want the Tories out, that kind of makes sense. But
Rob, but those numbers are quite surprising. I mean, usually, I mean, we do all sorts of polling, and YouGov do this quite a lot on various things, referenda, single issues, whatever else it is. Do you want a referendum? Things generally, people are quite up for voting. They quite like having their voice heard
and their say.
It's interesting there, and it would be really interesting to see more of the partisan breakdown. But if that is more Labour voters, then that suggests a certain lack of confidence of Conservatives at least Conservative
stormy.
Supporters.
I'll read it out. So the voting intention, bear in mind this is current voters, should be an election. Tories, 15% of them should, 76 shouldn't. Labour, 65 should, 22 shouldn't. Lib Dem, 48 should, 45 shouldn't. UKIP, 32 should, 58 shouldn't.
But it's interesting because, lots of, lots of the Conservative leadership and MPs and so on would be like, right, now is the time to smash Corbyn, smash this, useless opposition and take, like you say, 40, 50 seats or whatever.
There is a risk here, Rob, though, isn't there? Because, I mean, I guess the comparison people make it when we talk about snap elections is Gordon Brown, don't they? Because obviously the election that wasn't back in, when was it?
The parallels between Mayism and Brownism continue.
Was it 2007?
British jobs for British workers. And anyway, sorry.
The thing about the snap election, though, people forget that this lead that Labour took in the polls, I mean, that was a bounce off the back of their conference. People forget the Tory conference a week later with this announcement about inheritance tax. Mm. As soon as that came out, the Conservatives went into the lead. So if Brown's mistake was letting the speculation build up about an early election being possible, if he had actually called it, he could well have lost.
Mm. I mean, that's, wow. I guess that, Rob, that comes back to your messaging point earlier, doesn't it, about how I guess there is a risk for Theresa May if she does call an early election.
If May is planning on holding an early election, then she's done all that she possibly can to avoid the Brown situation, I would say.
Yes.
And I think there would be... It's always easy to find an excuse for saying why you've called an election. If, for the sake of, you know, if the EU open their negotiations with some sort of bombastic statement that essentially suggests that we're going to get nothing, she could easily turn around to the country and say, in order to win these negotiations, I need to have a strong mandate and go to the country. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Mm. I don't think many people would have a problem with that. In terms, you know, it's not like she's going to be punished for saying that she isn't going to hold an election.
And of course, then there isn't really the barrier for her there of a sort of really sort of pro-EU Labour Party saying, OK, let's have a general election and vote for us and we'll stay in, because Jeremy Corbyn doesn't seem like the type of guy that would fight that sort of campaign.
But they're not more to the moderates, right? I mean, the sort of lots of the moderate bit of the party have come out fairly strongly against sort of against immigration and sort of fairly in favour of hard Brexit. There's a sort of strange situation where both hardcore Remainers and hardcore Leavers seem to have had a prioritisation which has hard Brexit as their sort of as their preferred option to soft Brexit.
Mm. Let's move on to the race for the White House. Rob, this is your topic this week. So I guess for the benefit of people that aren't following it so close, so you're going to go into detail in a moment, but ever since last Monday's debate, it does seem like Hillary Clinton's had a boost in the polls. People are now speculating as to whether it's all over again and, you know, Hillary Clinton's going to win. I mean, what's your assessment of some of the recent data you've been looking at?
Yeah, so 24 out of 25 battleground state polls, I think it's what I'm right in saying, have had Clinton with a lead. That includes North Carolina, it includes Florida, which have now, under most people's models, certainly under the 538 model, moved into the Hillary column, having been voting Trump previously. That shifted the probability by quite a substantial amount in terms of it's gone from something like a 55-60% chance of a Hillary Clinton victory this time last week to now around 75%, depends which kind of assumptions you plug into that, but a pretty significant move, and that's reflected in a national poll movement of 3 or 4 points. So, you know, if you imagine that previously it was the lead was maybe half a point, 1 point, all very much margin of error stuff, decisive shift towards having leads of kind of 5 or 6, which, you know, under most assumptions would see her taking the White House. I think the interesting thing is the relationship between those national movements and those swing state polls, because that's what ultimately this will boil down to on election day. As we know, it's an electoral college rather than a popular vote. And that's what those of our viewers who can see on the left-hand side of the screen is probably slightly too small to read, but it's available on the 538 website. And I just thought it was a really interesting article that went up, I think, yesterday. And what it's looking like at is when the national polls move or when specific state polls move, how that is correlated with other states moving. So, you know, we talk about wave elections sometimes where if you see a 2%, 3% lead and that's reflected over the whole country, a uniform swing, and that sees, you know, can actually see small movements translating to quite, in first past the post, translating to quite big movements in terms of the number of seats. So we saw it in the congressional elections in 2010 when the Republicans were predicted to take the House, but by no means were expected to take in such a landslide, and they sort of cleaned up on the whole, you know, across the board. Interestingly, this time, looking at the correlations by voter groups within state polls. So the idea here is, how would Trump win? And I think most of the most positive news for Trump has been, you know, he's maintained his lead amongst non-college-educated whites, which tend to index pretty highly in states like Ohio, though actually that has recently just tiny, like, switch to like a 51% chance for Hillary. But anyway, his vote's holding up there. But also, there's lots of those people in bits of Michigan and Wisconsin and other places. So, you know, if he could stitch together a bigger turnout amongst non-college educated whites, could he therefore get the presidency? And more importantly, if he was winning Ohio and Michigan, which other swing states would that take with it? And the interesting thing that Nate pulls out here is that North Carolina and Florida actually have some of the lowest correlations with that due to their different demographic makeup. So, you know, North Carolina is divided between, a different group that votes very strongly for Trump, which is evangelical evangelical whites, often non-college educated, but different to the kind of blue-collar workers of the steel, Rust Belt, and so on. And Hillary's vote is different again. So rather than kind of Reagan Democrats or whatever, it's college-educated people living in the Research Triangle. So it was just, I think it's an interesting thing that actually Hillary could lose Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin and still sneak it if she's able to hold on to North Carolina and Florida.
And Florida itself was one I was looking at earlier, which there was a Quinnipiac poll that had like a 6 or 7 point lead for Clinton. That's by no means representative of every poll. Mm. I mean, some of them have been much, much closer. But I feel like instinctively, if I kind of assume that any victory for Trump has to involve him winning Florida. Maybe that's wrong. I'm sure there are paths to the presidency.
Well, this is what I mean. So Nate Silver posits North Carolina as the kind of roadblock, and I can't remember the exact arithmetic off the top of my head, but I think there is a way in which, yeah, that he can win the presidency, but he has to do a whole load of things. And what's interesting about these correlations is that they define, if you like, four different battlegrounds, and they're very much potential battlegrounds of the future. So you've got the Northeast, Maine, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, which have got a particular kind of, you know, demographic makeup. Very little, relatively speaking, smaller groups of ethnic minorities, certainly low numbers of Hispanics or and African Americans. The Midwest, as I say, that kind of blue-collar Reagan Democrat, still Rust Belt, whatever. The West, which again, different, Colorado, Nevada, Arizona, and then the South. And you've got, you know, interesting dynamics there in terms of, you know, what, even looking beyond this election, what the electoral demography of the United States will actually be in terms of, you know, will the Democrats recover in the South due to kind of, you know, inward investment, yeah, you know, educated workforce and obviously large African-American population. You know, similarly in the West, is there going to be, you know, more Democrats winning there, given, you know, Hispanic migration and so on. But also in the Northeast and Midwest, you're going to see a Republican recovery, with a different kind of Republican Party that's appealing to this kind of, you know, blue-collar working class, you know, former Democrats. You know, so that's kind of, the, if you like, the tilting point of how this election could, you know, portray what the future is going to hold.
Mm. I mean, Matt, one of the comparisons that we've made on this show and has been made elsewhere is, you know, with the Brexit vote, and I guess could the polls be wrong?
Yeah.
You're one of the people that sort of, you know, the main person that called out the general election being wrong here. Mm. Do you see any parallels that maybe could encourage a Trump fan?
Well, the thing that's absolutely fascinating looking at this from my sort of bird's eye view of it is that if you look at the actual headline numbers, the lead that Clinton has at the moment is almost exactly Obama's winning margin from 2012. And yet under the surface you get all of this huge churn among different demographic groups, so university educated versus not, a big gender divide opening up, a bigger ethnic divide, and all of these things not only have this effect on the electoral college because of different swing states having different demographics, but it is also a huge challenge for the pollsters, because you might have something that worked perfectly well in 2012 and for however many elections before that, but if you can have the right share of each party's voters but not necessarily have the right type of each party's voters. And so if you get this churn, which in some ways is comparable to what happened at the general election, it does present quite a big challenge, and that's before you start talking about the third party candidates, which between them have got about 10% of the vote. And then, of course,
that's going to vary state by state. And you know,
absolutely. And I think in North Carolina, the Greens are not on the ballot paper, if I remember. Is that?
That could be. Yeah, I hadn't heard that, but it's more than believable.
They're not on the ballot paper everywhere. That's
no, exactly. Yeah. And then also in terms of the Brexit thing, if you've got differential enthusiasm, you could have this thing where maybe it skews turnout one way or skews the samples the other way, and it's the net of the two. I mean, this is a very... I'm not saying that the polls are going to get it wrong, but the chances of them getting it, the level of difficulty in this is very, very high.
I suppose it comes back to what Rob was saying a moment ago, though, of course, because they can make a definite argument for the Rust Belt surge in turnout amongst less educated whites, you know, takes a lot of those states for Trump. But as you were saying, Rob, some of the other states like North Carolina, Florida...
That dynamic's just not in play.
Dynamic isn't there. What do you think about the... very briefly on the vice presidential debate last night, I almost feel like guilty bringing it up. It doesn't feel like it's going to make a huge amount of difference. But I was looking at some of the highlights earlier. Certainly felt like Mike Pence was seen to win the debate, but they don't typically have an impact, do they, on the main event?
No, I mean, a few things. I mean, less media coverage, just in general. Less interesting stuff to clip. But perhaps, I can't remember, again, I think it was Nate Silver, actually, who was saying that one interesting dynamic could be that whilst Pence was felt, I think, to kind of just about shade it, not least because, the other side were just harping in and interrupting them the whole time, actually the failure to necessarily that robustly defend Trump's record could make for some interesting clips and be used in attack ads against him. So I think it could be one of those things where, yeah, we'll shade it a win for Pence, but it won't make more than one media cycle, and it could, in terms of paid media, run against him.
Yeah, I mean, I think my acid test is always, does the swing voter in, non-Eaton, or in this case, Florida, really care that much about the vice presidential debate? I suspect the answer is no, but there could well be other, could have effects elsewhere.
Well, who knows? We're both candidates, potentially not serving full, 8 years or full 4 year terms for various reasons. One of these two men could end up in the White House. Who knows? But that's all we've got time for this week, folks. Rob and Matt, thank you very much for joining me. That's all from this week's politicalbetting.com Polling Matters show. Don't forget to subscribe to Tip TV's YouTube channel, and also to the Polling Matters podcast on iTunes or Android if you use those devices. We'll be back next week looking more closely at the next upcoming presidential debates in the US, and again, at what we learn from the party conference season.